Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Disease Activity Assessment and Outcomes Measurement for Rheumatoid Arthritis in Routine Care, which is certified by the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas and presented by Yusuf Yazıcı, MD. Dr. Yazıcı is an assistant professor, New York University School of Medicine, New York, New York. Dr. Yazıcı has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Centocor Research and Development, and Genentech. He served as an advisor or consultant for Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Centocor Research and Development, Genentech, Merck & Company, and UCB Pharma. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Bristol-Myers Squibb Company and Genentech. Dr. Yazıcı does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Yazıcı does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to improve the assessment, diagnosis, and management of patients with rheumatoid arthritis to achieve optimal patient outcomes. This activity is supported by Abbott Laboratories and UCB Pharmaceuticals. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Yusuf Yazıcı, Assistant Professor of Medicine at NYU School of Medicine and Director of the Seligman Center for Advanced Therapeutics and Behçet Syndrome Evaluation, Treatment and Research Center at NYU Hospital for Joint Diseases in New York. I'd like to welcome you to this Medscape CME video lecture discussion entitled Disease Activity Assessment and Outcomes Measurement for Rheumatoid Arthritis in Routine Care. As you know, randomized controlled trials are the foundation for evaluation of therapies. They also provide the data for all our guideline statements, both from the American College of Rheumatology and European League Against Rheumatism. They meet the criteria for scientific experiment, and it is the only method for studying patients not selected for therapies. However, there are shortcomings of randomized controlled trials that makes it difficult to apply the data from these studies into routine everyday care. Part of the problem is patient selection. Most of the time, only the sickest patients with very active disease are eligible for randomized controlled trials, and that makes them the small minority that we see in everyday care. Also, several statistically significant results might come out from the studies, but they're not necessarily applicable to everyday care. When we look at remission rates from routine care patients, both in Europe and the US, we see that only about 10 to 40% of patients, depending on which outcome measure we're looking at, achieve remission. Remission, or at least low disease activity, is our current aim when we're treating rheumatoid arthritis patients. Several studies have looked at how remission can be achieved in patients treated in routine care. The first of these was the TICORA study done in Scotland in the late 1990s. The aim of the study was not to test a certain type of medication, but to compare ways of treating rheumatoid arthritis patients and using the same medication. What the investigators did was separate the patients into two groups. One group received the routine care that they would normally get, and the second group was the intensive therapy arm, where they had their disease activity measured every month, and their medications were changed if they didn't meet certain targets. The decision was not left up to the physician, but to the disease activity score. Everybody started at the first box with sulfasalazine, and if they didn't achieve this target, they went to the second box where methotrexate was added, then the third box where other medications were added further on. If you're in the routine care arm, the decision to go from one box to the other was solely left up to the physician, and no disease activity measurement was involved in there. Patients were followed for 18 months, and at the end of 18 months, every disease activity measure that was reported, it was better if you're in the intensive therapy arm. If you look at the ACR20 responses, 91% in the intensive group and only 64% in routine care. If we look at remission rates, 65% of the patients in the intensive therapy group were in remission versus only 16% in routine care. In addition to clinical signs and symptoms, when we looked at the X-ray scores, patients who were in the intensive therapy group had much less progression of their X-ray scores than routine care. This was one of the first studies that showed, even if we use the same drugs, if we were using an outcome measure, we were able to achieve better results. After this, the same group decided to do a follow-up study, saying that now that we've established measurement is important, does it make a difference if we start with one medication or we start with combination of medications? So they again divided up their patients into two, where one group started with a single drug, what we call the step-up therapy, and then increased and added other medications down the road. The second group started with a combination of triple therapy of methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and hydroxychloroquine. These patients were followed for 3 months, and if their disease activity was not changed, then they went on to TNF inhibitors and other drugs. When the patients were compared at the end of the year, there was no difference seen in ACR20, ACR50, or ACR70 responses, or EULAR remission or EULAR good response results, suggesting that it did not make a difference how the patients used the medications initially, as long as they were followed closely with their disease activity measured and aggressively treated to get to a certain target, the patients did similarly. This led to the BEST trial, designed by Dutch rheumatologists, to look at further ways of treating rheumatoid arthritis. They took four groups of patients. Group one went through the sequential monotherapy of treatment, where they started with one drug, the dose was maximized. If the patient was not responding, that drug was stopped, and they went to the second drug. If that didn't work, that was stopped, and they went to the third way. This is the way we used to treat rheumatoid arthritis. The second group of patients did the step-up combination, which is the current way we treat rheumatoid arthritis, where we start with one drug, we maximize the dose. If the patient's not having enough of a response, then we add a second drug. If that doesn't work, we add a third drug, and we keep adding drugs until we can get the disease activity to the desired target. The third arm was one of the initial combination arms, which was borrowed from the COBRA trial done in the late 1990s, where patients started with methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and high doses of prednisone, 60 milligrams, which was tapered down to 7.5 milligrams over 2 months. And the last group was the most intensive therapy group, where patients started with infliximab and methotrexate from the beginning. All of these patients had their disease activity measurement done at 3 months, and if they didn't reach the target, they went further down the treatment algorithm. When these patients were compared at the end of 1 year, it was shown that the group that started out with the combination therapies, group 3 and group 4, was doing better than the initial single drug groups, group 1 and group 2. However, at the end of 2 years, there was no difference noted in the functional score of these patients, so everybody was at the same place as far as disease activity control was concerned. When we look at their X-ray scores, though, there was still a slight difference benefiting the group that started with the combination therapy, where they had less progression of joint damage compared to the monotherapy arms. However, when we look at the actual score of the progression, 2 units versus 1 unit out of a potential 448 unit change in the X-ray score, it was a statistically significant result, but not really clinically relevant to the everyday routine practicing rheumatologist. A group from Sweden took things one step further, where they said, well, we have this information that combination therapy works, measurement works, but how do we apply this to everyday routine care? So they took their patients who had less than 1 year of disease, had active disease, and were on no medications, and randomized everybody to taking methotrexate, which is what we would normally do for most of our patients who come in with rheumatoid arthritis. After 3 months, which is a normal assessment time for patients, patients who were not having a response were either switched over to adding infliximab, a biologic agent, so a combination with biologic and methotrexate, or adding sulfasalazine and hydroxychloroquine, the triple therapy that was tested in the TICORA studies. Then these patients were followed out to 1 year, and then after that out to 2 years. First, if you look at the group that responded to methotrexate and that did not go into the study at 3 months, that was about 30% of the total group, they were still doing well at the end of 1 year, with 75% of the patients maintaining the response they had at 3 months, which tells us and confirms that methotrexate does work, but for majority of patients, we will probably need to add a different medication on top of it. If you look at the two arms, patients who did not respond to methotrexate and had additional medications added, arm A was the group that got the triple therapy, and arm B was the group that got the biologic agent. If you look at achieving EULAR good response at the end of 1 year, there was a statistically significant difference where the group that got the biologic did better than the group got that triple therapy. If you look at the ACR20, ACR50, and ACR70 responses, in all of those, adding the biologic was better than adding triple therapy, which tries to answer one of the questions we frequently get from other physicians and also our patients, that if we have the choice, for most of our patients, probably adding the biologic is the better option. Triple therapy also works, but comparing the two, probably the biologic is the way to go. A French group also looked at this question, and they take their patients and gave half of them methotrexate alone and half of them methotrexate and a biologic from the beginning. At 3 months, the patients were assessed with disease activity scores, and if they were not having enough of a response, the methotrexate patients had a biologic agent, this time adalimumab, added to their regimen. And all of the patients were assessed at 1 year. Early on in the course, at 3 months, more of the patients on the combination had low disease activity compared to the patients who were taking methotrexate alone. However, once those who were not responding to methotrexate had adalimumab added on, at 1 year, everybody was in the same place where two-thirds of the patients were in low disease activity. And there were no differences in the number of patients with adverse events, again suggesting there is this window of opportunity early on in disease activity where we can try one medication and those who are not responding can go on to a biologic combination. Of course, all of these studies point out that medications are important, but it seems more important that we actually measure disease activity at certain intervals and adjust our treatment accordingly. One of the other pieces of evidence that we have that suggests that we should be measuring comes from imaging studies. There was a study done where they took patients who were in remission and followed them for 1 year, and they had serial x-rays, ultrasound examinations, and MRIs of their joints during this time. The aim was to see if there was any progression in joint damage in patients who were clinically in remission. 102 patients were referred who were thought to be in remission by their rheumatologist, and they went into the study. Before the study started, all of these patients had their disease activity measured, and it turned out that only 56% of the patients were truly in remission, suggesting just assessing the patients without using a tool, half the time the rheumatologists were correct in knowing if the patient was truly in remission or not. And when they looked at their x-rays, ultrasounds, and MRIs, patients who were in true remission did not have any progression in their joint counts or joint damage. Whereas if you had disease activity, you saw worsening x-ray scores at the end of 1 year. In early 1990s, there was a study done looking at all the randomized controlled trials in rheumatoid arthritis done in the 1980s. It showed that there were more than 180 different outcome measures were used in these trials. That made it impossible to compare any trial with one another, and the practicing physician didn't really know what to use or what to take out of these studies that they can use when they were treating their own patients. So the American College of Rheumatology and the World Health Organization came together to decide on a core data set measures, which would be used by every randomized controlled trial, in addition to additional measures that they want to use for that specific trial. This way, it would be easier to compare one trial from the other, and the information would be more useful. They decided on 7 measures, which were swollen joint count, tender joint count, physician global assessment, a laboratory marker, either an ESR or a CRP, a measurement of physical function, patient pain, and patient global assessment. And if the trial was going to go more than a year, then radiographs would be included. Before these measures were available, rheumatologists always had some of the laboratory tests in their armamentarium in deciding when treatments should be changed. We commonly use the sedimentation rate and the CRP as markers of inflammation, and also rheumatoid factor and CCP antibodies as a probably prognostic factor for worse disease. However, when we look at the population, we see that at best, 65 to 70% of patients have any of these values abnormal. So a good third of our patients, even when they had active disease, didn't have any abnormalities in their lab tests, which didn't make these tests very useful. Also, when you ask a group of rheumatologists if they do formal tender and swollen joint counts in routine care, less than 50% of the rheumatologists do a formal joint count in less than 50% of their rheumatoid arthritis patients, which makes it difficult for them to implement any measure that involves a joint count in everyday routine care. These are good for randomized controlled trials, but probably not that useful in everyday care. Based on all this information, American College of Rheumatology and the European League Against Rheumatism came up with different composite disease activity measures, which utilize 3 or 4 of the 7 ACR core datasets. The DAS28, the Disease Activity Score 28, uses the joint counts plus a laboratory test plus a patient global assessment. SDI, the Simplified Disease Activity Index, is very similar, which adds a physician global assessment. Clinical Disease Activity Index is the simple version of the Simplified Disease Activity Index, where there is no requirement for a lab test. And finally, RAPID-3, which is the Routine Assessment of Patient Index Data 3, uses 3 patient measures: patient function, patient pain, and patient global assessment. The American College of Rheumatology adapted these measures as part of their official 2008 recommendations. And they've used the cutoff points for low disease activity, moderate disease activity, and high disease activity as the starting point of the algorithm for treating rheumatoid arthritis patients. Before we decide on a treatment, we would assess the disease activity and go down a certain pathway depending on the result. If you look at the ACR measures, and when we say ACR 20, ACR 50, and ACR 70, we mean at least a 20% improvement, 50% improvement, or 70% improvement in these measures. However, because this is a change score, so we need to know what the patient was doing at the baseline and also at follow-up, it's not easy to use in routine care. The other scores that we have, the disease activity score and DAS28, are single numbers that will give us the actual disease activity at any given time, and it makes it easier to compare patients in routine care. The problem with the DAS28, or the disease activity score 28, is that it requires a difficult calculation that you can't really do in your mind. So you need to either use a website or a calculator to get to the score. The Simplified Disease Activity Index and the Clinical Disease Activity Index try to get over this problem, where all the variables are just simply added together to get to a certain value. The problem remains that the physicians have to do a formal 28 joint count for tender joints and 28 joint count for swollen joints to get to this value. Also, if you're doing the DAS28 and the SDI, you also have to have the laboratory test available at the time of visit. This brings up the question, how about using a measure where the patient is the driving factor for collecting the data? There are very good reasons why rheumatologists should collect patient self-report data in routine clinical care. It turns out that patient-reported measures are very well correlated with joint counts, sedimentation rate, and also X-ray damage. They are reproducible, and they are as informative as the other measures that we have. That's one of the reasons why the ACR recommendations, and also later on the European League Against Rheumatism recommendations, mention all of these measures as interchangeable and ask the physicians to pick one and use it in their care. In addition to being useful for clinical care, these patient questionnaires also are very relevant to the patient and the family. It tries to bring out problems that are important to the patient, and that will probably help them determine if they're going to be compliant with medication or not. The Multidimensional Health Assessment Questionnaire, MDHAC for short, is the patient questionnaire that's used most commonly. It has questions about patient function, patient pain, patient global assessment, patient fatigue, the medications they're using, psychological status, and also global status. We have been using this at NYU for the last 10 years, and we find it to be very useful, and also patients seem to like it. Out of the MDHAC has the RAPID-3 grown, where we take 3 of the measures out of all the measures on the MDHAC and turn it into a composite index, where we have patient function, score 0 to 10, patient pain, score 0 to 10, and patient global assessment, score 0 to 10. Earlier, we had versions of RAPID-4 and RAPID-5, where RAPID-4 added a patient self-report joint count, and RAPID-5 added a physician global assessment. However, our studies have shown that RAPID-4 and RAPID-5 perform very similarly to RAPID3, and it's better to keep things simple, so RAPID3 is the one that we've picked to use. If you compare RAPID3 to the industry standard DAS28, we see that it has similar categories like remission, low disease activity, moderate disease activity, and high severity, and the cutoff points are very well correlated. So if you're using the RAPID3, the score is from 0 to 30 because each component is scored 0 to 10. And if you have a score over 12, it's high severity. 6 to 12 is moderate, 3 to 6 is low, and less than 3 is near remission. And that's where we're targeting with our treatments. One more advantage of the patient measure is that most of the work is done by the patient before they come in to see the physician. We had a study where we actually timed all these measures to see how long it would take for both the physician and patient to do it. It turns out it takes about an average of 90 seconds to a formal joint count. If you're doing a full hack, it also takes about 40 seconds. But the RAPID3, already filled by the patient while they're waiting to see the physician, takes only about 10 seconds to score. And you have a very good measure that you can use as a target, and you can also share with the patients. If we do a correlation, which we did in close to 300 patients, the correlation comes out to be 0.6, which is better than the correlation that we see with sedimentation rate and CRP, and for clinical tools is actually a very good correlation, meaning they can be used interchangeably. If you look at patients who had high or moderate disease activity in either score, it turns out that 80% of the time, the same patients were captured either with a RAPID3 or a DAS28. The same applies to patients with low disease activity or remission, where close to 70% of the time, the same patients were captured. This is good enough for clinical care, and that's one of the reasons why ACR has recommended it, and we use it in our everyday routine care. One of the objections that we commonly hear about patient-reported outcomes is that they're subjective measures compared to more objective measures like the tender joint, swollen joint, and physician global assessment. However, when we look at the data, we see that it's actually the swollen joint count and the tender joint count that has at least 20% placebo response built into it. Meaning, if a patient is getting a placebo, not the real drug, 20% of the time, physicians think that their swollen joint counts and tender joint counts improve. However, if you ask the patient about their pain and their physical function, we see that the patients on placebo don't really improve at all, which is what should be happening because they're not getting the real drug. So if we're basing our decisions on data, it's actually the patient measures that are more objective reflections of what's really going on with the treatment. In addition, other people have looked at clinical trial data and created different disease indices that consisted of only patient measures, patient plus sedimentation rate, assessor measures, and all the core ACR data set. And when they compared any one of these with the actual measures that were used in the trial, which were ACR20 and DAS scores, it turned out all of them perform similarly. Again, making the point that all of these measures are similar in the way they work. They're all useful in clinical care, but it becomes important to pick one that would work for our routine care patients. We at NYU, because the patient measures are much shorter to do and less of a burden on the physician, prefer using the RAPID3. But anyone can use any of these tools as long as we're using one of them and treating to a target that we pick. ACR came up with rheumatoid arthritis treatment guidelines in 2008. And this was the first set of guidelines from the ACR where disease activity was at the top of the treatment algorithm, where physicians were asked to assess their patients using one of the tools of DAS28, CDI, SDI, RAPID3, or one of the older ones, VADI and PASS, and decide if the patient had mild disease, moderate disease, or severe disease. And depending on the disease activity and every 3 to 6 months monitoring of disease activity, they would go down a treatment algorithm and pick certain medications. These guidelines are due for updating soon. European League Against Rheumatism, EULAR, came up with their own rheumatoid arthritis treatment guidelines last year in 2010. They started out with the overarching principles where a rheumatologist probably is the best person to take care of a rheumatoid arthritis patient. And also, patients and the physicians should work together when they're making treatment decisions and also in long-term follow-up. Rheumatoid arthritis medications are also expensive, especially the biologic agents that we're using more and more can be burdensome on some of the patients, and this cost has to go into the treatment decisions that we make. If we come to the actual recommendations themselves, most of them are similar to the American College of Rheumatology recommendations in that patients should start with methotrexate as the initial choice and at least treated for 3 months before a response is assessed. If methotrexate can't be used, then leflunomide, sulfasalazine, or gold can be used instead of methotrexate. Combination DMARDs can be considered, especially in patients who are not responding to methotrexate. However, at the 3 months or sometimes up to 6 months after methotrexate use, if the patients are not having adequate response, probably a biologic agent should be started. The slight difference with the EULAR recommendations and the ACR recommendations is that EULAR recommendations tend to suggest a TNF inhibitor should be the first biologic used. We, in the US, think any of the biologics that has enough data can be a first-line agent. After the biologics, we again continue monitoring our patients every 3 to 6 months, and if they're not reaching the targets, then it's time to switch from one biologic to another. EULAR recommendations also bring up the concept of drug-free remission. So if a patient achieves remission on the current treatment, then there might be an opportunity to stop one or more of the drugs and keep the patients in remission without any medication. Again, this is one of the areas where the US rheumatologists and the European rheumatologists don't agree, in that because only about 1 in 7 patients who are in remission will flare after their drugs are stopped, and only 6 will stay in remission, that seems like a big risk to take, at least to us. So currently, the ACR recommendations say that whatever number of medications were required to put a patient into remission, they will stay on that medication in combination as long as they have their disease. What we do in our clinical practice is kind of a combination of both methods. We use the MDHACK and the Rapid3 as our guiding tool and adjusting therapy. We start our patients with methotrexate and low-dose prednisone, as it might take 2 to 4 weeks before methotrexate starts working, and prednisone provides some relief while the patients are waiting for methotrexate to work. If, after we maximize the methotrexate dose up to 20 to 25 milligrams after 3 months, the patients are not responding, and their Rapid3 score is more than 12 out of 30, then I will add a biologic agent. Currently, 4 biologic agents have similar data in methotrexate-naive patients, early rheumatoid arthritis patients, methotrexate failures, and also biologic failures. And I will pick one of these and start as the first biologic. If the patient's not responding after 3 to 6 months, then I will try one of the other ones. Some of the newer biologic agents, as they get more data, will also be eligible to be a first-line biologic agent. So in conclusion, in routine care, we have measures that can be used, some more easier than others, but we need to use one measure and pick a target and treat our patients towards that target. The traditional measures we used to use, like sedimentation rate and maybe the joint counts, may not be the best measures for everyday care, as they take more effort and they're not always available. And when we're interpreting randomized controlled trial data, we always have to keep in mind that the patients we see in everyday routine care might not be the exactly same patients that took part in the randomized controlled trials, and this might need some adjustment on our part when we're using the data. Thank you very much for joining us for this Medscape educational activity. Please continue on to the post-test to obtain CME credit for this program.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Disease Activity Assessment and Outcomes Measurement for Rheumatoid Arthritis in Routine Care. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.